Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet and you meet.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
Amy Stockwell Mercer with us. She is the author of Smart Woman's Guide to Diabetes, authentic advice on everything from eating to dating and to motherhood. She was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at age 14, and her life was forever changed by insulin injections, the need for diabetic diet, the ongoing fears of complications that could result in eye or kidney disease. 25 years later, Amy's a freelance writer and the mother of the three healthy boys. She's the author again of The Smart Woman's Guide to Diabetes, authentic advice on everything from eating to dating to motherhood. And Amy, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. There's so many women, I'm sure, are affected with diabetes. Let's lay a base and let's start from the beginning. Amy, on a practical level, what is diabetes?
On a practical level, as most people know, there are two basic different forms. There's type 1 and type 2. And type 1 used to be called juvenile diabetes. And that's what I have, and that's only about 10% of the population of people with diabetes. But that's when your body, for some still unknown reason, stops producing insulin. And so whenever you eat, whenever you need to eat, your body's just not functioning properly. It's an autoimmune illness. And so type 1 diabetics have to either wear a pump to pump insulin into their body, or they need to give injections throughout the day. And type 2, you know, is more adult onset, but it's still the same basic function of a person's pancreas and insulin not functioning properly in their body. So it's really something that affects 24 hours a day. Everything that you ingest, you have to think carefully about what you're eating and how much you're eating, and how it's a very almost a scientific illness.
Okay, so what we're really dealing with, it's lifelong. Once you've got it, you've got it.
Right.
And it's marked by very high levels of sugar in the blood, and the symptoms are high blood levels of glucose. They can cause several problems, obviously.
Right.
They can affect your vision. They can affect so many things, thirst, fatigue, frequent urination. I mean, this list goes on.
Right.
Is there any way to stop this? I mean, we know what it is. We know what it does. The doctors have a decent handle on it. What do you think it is that why we haven't been able to find a cure for it?
Wouldn't that be nice? You know, I was diagnosed 26 years ago, this October, actually. And when I was diagnosed, my doctor said to me, you know, the doctors, kind of just what you said, the doctors have a good handle on this, and there's new stuff being invented all the time. And I can almost guarantee that you're going to see a cure in 10 years. You know, and here I am 26 years down the road, and there's still no cure in sight. And that's not to say a lot of advancements have been made since in the 1920s was when insulin was discovered. And before insulin was discovered, if you got diabetes, you would die within a matter of months. There are great strides have been made, certainly, but still, it's still a chronic day, you know, hour after hour, day after day illness that is very, very costly, very time-consuming, and without good care can lead to horrible complications. So, you know, I'm not a doctor, and I don't know, but living with it for 26 years, I certainly wish they would come up with something better than what we have. You know, it doesn't feel that different to me than the tools I had 26 years ago. It doesn't feel like too much has changed in that amount of time, unfortunately.
Now, by the way, obviously it's treatable with, and you mentioned it, insulin. Now, what actually is insulin?
Insulin is a hormone, you know, and they discovered it, these scientists discovered it from working with dogs in Toronto, I think, in the 1920s. And it's injectable, or you can also put insulin into a pump that you wear on your body and, and is secreted into your body throughout the day. But insulin, you have insulin in your body. Everybody has insulin, which is produced by the pancreas. Anytime you take a bite of anything to eat, a drink of anything, your body kicks out however much insulin you need to cover what you're eating. My body doesn't. So it's a hormone that regulates the sugar that's absorbed by whatever you ingest.
Now, what was it like living with that, especially as a teenager? That had to be kind of there had to be some challenges that you had.
Right. And that's really when I started thinking about writing this book. I was diagnosed at 14 years old on the cusp of adolescence. And I say now I'm a 40-year-old mother of three, so my life is a lot different than it was when I was 14. It's a lot easier for me today to eat a balanced diet and to live a scheduled life. But when I was 14 years old, you know, teenagers, that's the last thing they want to do. Sure. Teenagers, your life is about being spontaneous and being unplanned. And so diabetes really, that was a difficult challenge for me as a teenager. And I think it's a difficult challenge for a lot of adolescents because it forces you to live a scheduled life. And there are ways around it, of course. If people listen and say, "Well, I don't have to live a scheduled life," there are ways around it. But to take the best care of yourself, living a scheduled life is the way to do it. And what teenager wants to do that?
No. What happens if you don't take the shot on time?
You would get very sick. And actually, that is there is an eating disorder which has come out of that. If you don't take insulin, your blood sugar goes up, and I can't really explain
that's okay. You've been there,
science,
you've done,
what happens. Your blood sugar goes up, you feel sick and you lose weight because it's like your body is almost eating itself. And so you lose weight really quickly. So a lot of young women do that on purpose, where they'll skip shots and they can drop weight quickly. And it's there's a term called diabulimia, which has been coined to describe this this problem. So it's a dangerous game.
Sure it is. But I think one of the most important things, and that, you know, you're here 26 years later to talk about it, it's not a death sentence. It's not a prison sentence.
Correct.
It is controllable. It's manageable. So what are one of the first things that we do? Can we do it through diet? How do we control this?
You know, again, it's really, I mean, the positive, I think, that you can kind of see from this, which is easier for me to see, like I said, as a 40-year-old woman. But really, the diabetic diet is the healthiest way because I remember when I was diagnosed back in 1985, one of the first things I said to my doctor was, "Well, can I still play sports?" Because I was on the field hockey team. And he said, yes, play sports. Yes, exercise is very important. So it was, you know, this is not a disease where you sit on the sidelines. This is a disease where exercising consistently is an important tool that helps you stay in good health. And so, consistent exercise and eating a balanced diet. It's really, you know, kind of a low carbohydrate, Well, a diet of moderation is how I look at it. So there are definite ways that you can live a long healthy life. It just takes dedication and planning.
Sure, it's called have a little focus and have a little bit of management of your life. There's 14, 15 million people in the United States with diabetes today. And I think, interestingly enough, a great percentage of those people, they're non-insulin dependent. I don't even think they know that they have it because the symptoms aren't strong enough. And is there any way to catch it beforehand? Because you get up to your 50s, then it starts to show, and then the problems really start. So is there any indicators that you may have it before it gets bad enough where you have to do insulin?
Right. Yeah. And I think those people maybe just get used to feeling bad. And I think they don't recognize it. And I don't know how similar or dissimilar the symptoms are between type 1 and type 2, but the basic symptoms are pretty detectable. I think that thirst, that constant need to go to the bathroom, and blurred vision. I experienced blurred vision, but I think the two big ones are really the thirst and the needing to go to the bathroom. And I'm almost 100% sure that type 2s experience those also. And so I think African Americans are at higher risk. Different ethnicities are at higher risk for type 2. If you're overweight, certainly you're at higher risk. So I just think basic screening, if you go to your practitioner once a year or every 6 months or something, get a blood test and get yourself checked out, because the sooner you catch it, the better, that you can start, and you'll feel so much better. I think these people probably get used to feeling, to not feeling well.
And then education, we really need to be
better educated about the signs and about how to take care of yourself. I think that's one thing that I would really like to do, with my book is to better educate people about the ways to take care of themselves and the ways, it's a very controllable, I hate that word control, but it's a controllable.
How about management? And obviously you've got to go to a doctor to treat it. But the treatment, we're talking about weight loss, exercise, medication.
Right.
Those daily treatments, I think, more important than anything else, help to maintain the diabetes in a way that it reduced the risks of some of the things that you've just talked about.
Exactly.
The constant urination, the blurry eyes, et cetera. Also, there can be some heart problems that go along with this if you don't do what you're supposed to do. Amy, let me ask you this. We're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. It's amystockwellmercer.com, and that's Amy, AmyStockwellMercer.com. And then my book is called The Smart Woman's Guide to Diabetes. So I also have a website that's thesmartwomansguidetodiabetes.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Amy Stockwell Mercer, we're out of time, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate your time.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. It isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I
think of the warm Caribbean. I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona. Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see. Come and sing a simple song of freedom. Sing it like you've never sung before.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark, the five languages of appreciation in the workplace, empowering organizations by encouraging people. Listen to the words, encouraging people. Our guest co-author is Dr. Paul White. He's a psychologist, an author, a speaker, and a consultant who helps make the workplace relationships work. And for the past two decades, he's improved numerous businesses, wealthy family estates, schools, and nonprofit organizations by helping them build healthy relationships, create positive workplace environments, and raising the level of job satisfaction for both employees and volunteers. And let us say, Paul White, welcome to the show.
Good evening.
Hi. And Paul, thank you so much for being here. I think that is so critical today. One of the biggest places that we miss out is that ability for the, if you're going to take it into the workplace, a corporation, a smaller business, is the ability for the supervision and the people who work there to connect. It's so critically important because that does affect the bottom line.
Absolutely, Mike. And what we find is I work with companies and organizations around the country that people are just discouraged. They're worn out. You know, they're having to do more with less, and so managers don't know what to do as well because, you know, businesses and organizations don't have extra money to give bonuses or raises, and so what we've tried to do is provide practical steps and tools to help managers and even coworkers support and encourage their colleagues.
Now, when we talk about support and encourage, I think one of the basic problems that we have in the country today in getting away from the workplace, what goes on is that ability for someone to recognize, acknowledge someone else. And I think one of the biggest problems that the kids have today, they don't get acknowledged, they don't get accepted, so they run to places where they do get acknowledged and accepted. And usually, Paul, those are places where the kids get in trouble. So if you take that same philosophy to the workplace, accept me, acknowledge me, let me know that I'm important to you, and all of a sudden you're going to get 150% out of me.
Yeah, it's interesting that I found that people desperately want to know that they are valued and what they do counts. But research and personal stories tell us that most people don't feel appreciated at work. In fact, one study shows that 65% of all the workers in the U.S. report that they received no appreciation or recognition in the past 12 months. So there's this sort of gap there. And it's interesting, on the other hand, as I talk to managers and supervisors, they feel like they are communicating appreciation, but what we're finding is they're not really hitting the mark. And that's where we see that appreciation to be communicated effectively has to be done regularly. It has to be done in the language that's important to the person. And that's why we developed this inventory called the Motivating by Appreciation Inventory that comes with the book that helps identify a person's primary and secondary language of appreciation and also the specific acts, because even within a language, let's say quality time, there's different ways that people like to experience that. For some people, it's focused attention. For other people, it's hanging out together, maybe at the end of the day. For other people, it's going out to lunch and chatting. So we want to help managers and supervisors be able to hit the mark by knowing what their people really want.
I think one of the most important things that you just said is in the language of. If I don't know how to communicate to you, if I don't know how to touch you in a way that you've learned to receive, there's no way we're going to be able to move in any direction together. And that's most important. You get a lot of managers, a lot of CEOs, CFOs that want the relationship, that want that engagement between themselves and the people who work with them, but they don't know how to say it. And that in and of itself is probably 80% of the problem out there.
Yeah, I would agree. And in fact, one of the challenges that we have to deal with is that people say, well, this appreciation stuff sounds sort of touchy-feely, and I'm not sure, you know, if it's going to work in manufacturing or in construction. But in actuality, we find that it's less about words and more about other actions as well, whether it's quality time, what we call acts of service, which is helping somebody out get something done, maybe help them get their computer to work right or get dig out from a pile of filing. And that it's not always words that people want, and sometimes we assume that. And so we've actually developed a quiz on our website called appreciationatwork.com. The quiz is, how dysfunctional is your workplace? And it gives people an idea of what, you know, does a healthy workplace look like? What does an unhealthy one look like? And sort of where does their work setting fit in that? And then gives some specific suggestions to help out.
Paul, you just proved your point in one word. When you said the word appreciation, you know, some people may consider it touchy-feely. I'll add some words to it, airy-fairy, yada, yada. And that's the key. They're not hearing it in a way that would get the effect that you're looking for. And it would be very interesting if we took the word appreciation, changed it to something else. If I said, here, I'm going to sell you something. Okay, all of a sudden you're backed off, you're defensive, you're waiting for it to happen. But if I said, here, let me offer you this. Just in the words, you're going to get a different reaction.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things that we found as we've worked with teams is that the people that really seem to value this are the colleagues and the coworkers. Yeah, supervisors and managers and business owners, or if you're a director of a nonprofit, they want to know how to encourage your people. But what I found interesting is that coworkers want to know how to encourage one another when they're having a bad day. And I had one gal say, okay, now I know how to encourage Ginger. What I was trying didn't work, and it actually made her more agitated. So I got to back off of that and do the actions that are important to her. And so we find that appropriately implementing these concepts helps reduce staff turnover, reduce actually volunteer turnover. It makes for less grumbling and gossip. And actually we find that managers report that their daily life at work becomes better because they don't have all this negative stuff going on around them.
Oh, absolutely. No question. And it's finding that common denominator that can get the collaboration that you're talking about. Years ago, probably 25 years ago, I was doing consulting for a business, and it happened to be a dental business. And I walked in, and it wasn't the manager, but as the consultant, they listened to what I was talking about. And I walked into a staff meeting one day, and I said to everybody, this is the last day that you'll ever get a pay raise. And everybody's eyes dropped, their mouth dropped, and their eyes glazed at me. And I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to start referring business. Everybody refer somebody to come in here. And we'll take a percentage of everything, all the new business. Let's say, I'll pick a number. Let's say the business made $20,000 last month. But based on this new way of bringing people in, let's say you've got $25,000 because everybody now is going out and making sure that people come in and participate in what's offered here. And then we're going to take a percentage of that excess and we're going to spread it through the entire group. We'll tell you what. The money at the end of the month went skyrocket because everybody was trying to get somebody in there and everybody was collaborating. And what did they have? They had a common denominator where everybody was helping everybody, and now they were vested in the business.
Right, and that's a great plan, Mike. I find that similar issue now that people want to know what they can do. They are concerned and anxious because of the economy, because of government actions or inaction, and they feel pretty powerless. And so we try to help people see you can have influence and make your workplace better and make it more competitive to survive the difficult economic times. We actually show that focusing on appreciation and recognition improves customer satisfaction, and in some cases it improves actually productivity of the workers as well. One of the things we've done on the website of appreciationatwork.com is give people the opportunity to tell their stories. And so we have a national workplace fill-in-the-thanks contest where they can either give a positive example of when they felt appreciated at work or fill in, you know you're not appreciated at work when. And unfortunately, we see a lot of painful stories. But we're giving out a prize of, you know, a book plus $25 to have an ice cream party with your colleagues for people. And it's really eye-opening to see the different things that people are telling stories about.
You know, I want to go back to the appreciation and encouragement with the touchy-feely, because one of the things that I know you talk about, it's like for some of the groups, like the traditional, quote-unquote, the tough guy industries, the construction, manufacturing, they want the same thing. The words may be different, but there is no difference between that and somebody who, quote-unquote, they don't get their hands dirty. There is no difference. It's all in the language, and that's really the key. It's all in the language and the way that that language is brought in and interpreted.
Yeah, in fact, Mike, I had a school leader who was also a coach that he was involved in the training we were doing, and he called me and said, you know, Paul, appreciate what you're doing here, but I just need to let you know I don't need to hear that I'm appreciated. And he was right. As we got to know each other, he didn't need to hear it verbally. But what I found out is that his language was time, and that if you went and hung out with him at his practice and saw what he did and the interaction with the kids, man, you were his best buddy. And you couldn't stop him from talking and tell about it. And it was really encouraging to him that somebody was interested. So a lot of times it's not the words, it's actions. And, you know, we have tangible gifts, which is one of the languages. And we're not talking about big things, not a bonus or raise or a flat screen TV. It's more about small things that show that you know the person and, you know, are interested in them. So if they're, you know, a football fan, you may get them one of the preview magazines about the football season. Or if you know they like Starbucks, you get them their favorite thing. Or some, you know, maybe movie tickets or whatever it might be. It's less about the amount and more that you're getting to know them and think about them away from work.
Absolutely, no question about that. And I'm going to go back to acknowledgement. Appreciation is what everybody, that's an innate need, and not even a want. It's a need that we all have. And in one way, shape, or form, we need to be appreciated. And somebody out there has got to know that we are human, we're alive too, and we are, and because of us, we're part of the mechanism that causes things to work.
Right, and you know, I find that most organizations want to do the right thing, but the biggest error that I think they make is they do group-based appreciation. So they'll send out a blast email, say, good job, team, you know, we finished a project and way to go. Or you may, for your volunteers or even your staff, you may have an appreciation dinner or a picnic. And the problem is that just doesn't hit the mark for most individuals. They want to know that you know what they did that contributed to it, and they want to hear something individual about it. And like the group picnic thing, that's actually torture for some people to go to a big social event and have to sort of negotiate that. So it's not positive for them. And the same thing can happen for, like, recognition and award ceremonies. I had one gal say, you know, you can give me an award, but you're going to have to shoot me to get me up there because I just don't want to do it. So we have to understand what each person's individual perspective is of what's encouraging or that they feel valued and then meet that need. And so that's why we feel like the inventory is really a key piece. And we're able to develop a group profile for the team to be able to know how to encourage and show appreciation to one another.
Wouldn't it be interesting, I'm just thinking about this as you're talking, that if you had the job application, and on that job application it said, just a simple question, how do you recognize appreciation? Or even simpler than that, and it would be very interesting to have that, and you would know ahead of time.
Yeah, great point, because I just had an HR person talk to me that they're planning to include our inventory, because you can get the inventory separately from the book if you want, as part of their orientation process. Now, I encourage them not to do it the first couple of weeks, because usually the first couple of weeks that people are sort of overwhelmed and anxious, and they may not have the trust of, you know, filling out a questionnaire about what you like and don't like. There's sort of question of motives. But to make that a part of their file so that the supervisor and others know from the get-go of how to show appreciation and encourage them. So I think you're right on the mark.
Yeah, and where else are you going to find out from the person themselves? And what a great question. I think that anybody's favorite topic is themselves. If you just start listening for a while, that's what you hear, me, 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 me. And one of the most important things is when you're in communication, basically, when you're addressing an audience, one person, 10 million, it doesn't matter. It has to shift from me to you. And I think that's where the biggest problem is. It's not that they won't do it. It's they don't know to do it. And what I'm seeing here with the book, which is right in front of me, Paul, what I'm seeing here basically is making that shift to every individual you out there that's within the organization. And that, in effect, I would venture to guess, and I'm going to pick a number out of the air, but I'll bet I'm not too wrong, about 90 to 95% of the businesses out there doing business are missing.
Right. In fact, there's a recent research that came out just a month ago that showed that 80% of the top corporations actually have employee recognition programs. But within those corporations, only about 30% of the employees actually feel valued for their daily work and doing a good quality job. Why? Because either it's group-based, or one of the interesting things is most employee recognition programs are based on seniority. So, you know, how motivating is that? Okay, I got to stay another 5 years to get recognized. So, you know, we've got to reward and acknowledge those things that we want to see. And I tell people, if you really want to encourage somebody, talk about their character. Say, you know, Joe, I really appreciate that you are faithful and dependable. And if I ask you to do something, I don't have to think twice about it going to get done. Or you're punctual, you're here, you know, you're a hard worker. And people, man, they light up and they'll go to the max for you on that.
And by the way, even if they're not, they'll become that just to confirm it. And I really think when it comes down to it, that that back to appreciation and recognition. I really believe if you looked at the culture that we live in today, everybody's screaming for that. And it's so right in everybody's face. It's in the media. It's all over the place. People get in trouble. And if you think about it, these kids that go out and kill people, which is not the greatest thing in the world to do, they're doing it for acknowledgement. So why not take acknowledgement and the very thing that we strive for and put it to some practical, workable, constructive use?
Right. And our goal has been to make things practical. We have a handout on our website, theappreciationatwork.com, that is the top 10 easiest ways to show appreciation to almost anybody. And we have other ones about picking up cues to know when people need to be encouraged, and how to not have praising your colleagues backfire on you, because the biggest thing you can do is try to fake it and not be authentic and genuine, because people have really sensitive radar to that, and they will pick up that you're not, you know, sincere about it, or you're not really dealing with other relational issues that you have to deal with first. And we talk about that in the book, about the issues that you have to address for appreciation to be considered authentic.
No question about it. And now we've got about a minute or so before we have to finish. But let me ask you this question, and I think this is going to be an interesting answer with this one. Anytime anybody's put anything to pen, whether it be fact, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be, you usually find out that we're somewhere in the middle of it. There's that epiphany. There's that aha moment, that cathartic moment when all of a sudden you realize there's something more to the subject matter than you knew before you started to research it and put it into pen. Paul, where was that for you?
It was when I was working with a manufacturing firm, and they brought me in. They had a difficult unit that had lost 30% of their staff in the last 3 months, and we gave them the inventory to find out how to encourage and show value to them. We helped them implement it through some just weekly meetings and emails. And what happened was, not only did they not lose any more people, but the people in that unit called two of their former employees and said, hey, this place has changed. You need to come back. And two of them actually came back and rejoined it. To me, that was powerful to say, this has impact and it's meaningful to people.
Well, and is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, absolutely. Our website is appreciationatwork.com. We've got both that How Dysfunctional Is Your Workplace quiz and also the contest you can enter, as well as other free resources for people to start to get an idea on how to implement these ideas.
Great. Hey, Paul White, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
All right. Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and
jungles and desert oasis, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Come and sing a simple song, freedom. Sing it like you've never sung before. Let it fill the air, tell the people everywhere. We the people here don't want a war. Hey there, Mr. Black Man, can you hear me? I don't want your diamonds or your game. I just want to be someone known to you as me. And I will bet my life you want the same. Come and sing a simple song of freedom. Sing it like you've never sung before. Let it fill the air. Tell the people everywhere, we the people here don't want a war. 700 million, are you listening? Most of what you read is made of lies. But speaking one to one, ain't it everybody's son?
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk. Addresser After Dark. We're fighting with the mouse right now, and the mouse won't do the... Here, let me have that. We're going to beat the mouse up because the mouse... There we go. You never know what happens behind a microphone. Natalie Rubenstein with us. She's the author of Alzheimer's Disease and Other Dementias, The Caregiver's Complete Survival Guide. She's a licensed clinical social worker and a certified geriatric care manager specializing in Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. And for 16 years now, she was the primary caretaker for her mother, who was diagnosed with dementia. She's worked for several years in the Wine Center for at Mount Sinai Medical Center in Miami Beach, Florida, which is ranked among the nation's top hospitals for geriatric care. And let us say, Natalie, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
We just fixed the mouse. That the timing couldn't be any
Hope the mouse doesn't have dementia.
Well, Radio Susie almost got it trying to get the mouse working. But the mouse is working, everything's recording, and we're in great shape. Natalie, let me ask you this. For you, with your mom, obviously, what was that like moving into that? The caregiving part.
Terrifying.
Absolutely.
Absolutely terrifying. I had absolutely no idea why my mother was acting the way she does and doing the things she does. And it was, that part was scary as a daughter. But then the other part was, that was even scarier, was the fact of being a caregiver and having God only knows what new responsibilities already thrown on my plate. And I think it's a mixture of two things, those two things.
Now, by the way, when it comes down to it, now you've got your mom, that person who has guided you, the person that was mom when you were a kid. That was the be all end all, and that was the end of it. Mom said it, and that was there you go. But now all of a sudden, it's a different person in front of you. It's a different person who hasn't got the ability to function and think like the person that you grew up with. So that in and of itself has got to be absolutely frightening. This is a person that born you, and now, for the most part, as it progresses, she doesn't even know you.
Well, I think the hardest part was the fact, like what you first just said, this is the person who guided you and loved you and cared for you and directed you. And all of a sudden, you've got this person in front of you who looks like your mom, sounds like your mom, and just sort of acts like your mom, but she's not your mom anymore. And that's very scary because you don't realize what's going on, and you're just praying to God that, you know, whatever it is, it's just going to turn around and disappear. And unfortunately, it doesn't.
You know, when I was a kid, I had never been exposed to Alzheimer or anything to do with dementia. But about 5 years ago, I watched a movie, and the movie was, let me see, what was the, oh, yeah, The Notebook. Did you see The Notebook?
Oh, I loved it. I read the book, too. It was excellent.
Yeah, and by the way, and I sat there, and I watched the entire thing, and the way that it was done in such a way that I got involved with the movie, that I had an understanding of what people go through with dementia that I'd never gotten in my entire life.
You know, it's a beautiful movie, and it's a very romantic movie, it's hard to look at it as a caregiver because when you've been that rejected by a partner, most of us don't have that kind of relationship, and a rejection by a partner is really going to turn the other person away, and in this situation, The Notebook, it actually brought them closer together. So when you're looking at a realistic point of view, I mean, if you think of all these caregivers out there who saw the movie, and many of them, when I would show it during my support groups, they would cry. And it wasn't they were crying because it was a sad movie. They were crying because these two people had a love that they never had. So that could be a little bit of a double-edged sword. I mean, it's a great movie to show about the forgetfulness. But, you know, the relationship was also equally as important in that movie.
See, but that was my first step. Now, that led me to another step. Radio Susie, who obviously she produces the show, she puts the whole thing together. Now, I met her mother some years back, 4 or 5 years ago. Her mother is one of the people that you're talking about. She has Alzheimer's, she has dementia, and I have watched, and I've watched over the years as it's progressed, and it's progressed to a point where I've seen her not recognize people, so I've seen the other side of it, and I've watched when Susie has had to go, you know, be a caregiver. Now, her mom is in assisted living home, and so they're there, but she's also got to go through that. So what this taught me was that Alzheimer's is not just for that person going through it, it's collectively the entire family, because once somebody in the family gets it, the entire family has it. Not necessarily the physical symptoms, but their involvement, the collaboration of getting this person on their feet.
Oh, without a doubt. It's not a one-person disorder. It affects the whole family in a myriad of ways and changes dynamics, if you think about it. You know, just needing to go to the assisted living facility, in, let's say, Susie's case, when she's going there, she's in a different mindset. But not only that, it's just one more activity that needs to be taken care of, which means it's that much time that she could spend with other family members or at the job or on vacation. It affects every aspect of people's lives, and especially caregivers.
Yeah, I remember I got invited to Susie's place for some dinner. I can't remember what it was, some holiday. And my sister and I had gone over there, and she had brought her mother over. I guess her daughter went to get her mother. Now, this is interesting because Susie had moved. She was in a completely different environment. Her mom came in, sat down at the table, had no idea that she was sitting in a different place.
You know, the really amazing stuff about the portion of dementia is that as caregivers, we're always so worried about how, you know, a move is going to affect somebody. And what happens is that people oftentimes, if they're surrounded by the people that they love and care about, the surroundings really don't matter to them. It's all about the humans that are sitting there, the human touch. The way people come together, the conversations, the tone of voice. I mean, those are the things that individuals with dementia really react strongly to. So they wouldn't recognize that it's a new house and new pictures or the flowers on the table. It's just really, they're in the here and now. And the here and now for them could just be this little spot in front of them, which actually could be the food on the plate at the dining room table.
Yeah, and but one of the other things, and I love the way you put this together with the problem and solutions, one of them would be the compulsive behaviors that that you talk about in the press releases. Dad keeps taking everything out of his wallet and then putting it back in again. How do you deal with those behaviors?
It's hard, Michael. And if I tell somebody to ignore them, it makes it even harder for the family members to understand this. When you can start to understand that every behavior has a reason and that there is a reason why dad is doing that or mom is doing that, once you get past the annoyance to us personally as caregivers and people who are spending time with individuals who have this problem of the compulsiveness, you realize that it's self-soothing. It's almost like being in a rocking chair and you just keep going and going and going. It calms people down. And oftentimes, you know, people are checking their purses. And I used to like to watch the Golden Girls, and you'd see Estelle Getty, and she always carried her purse everywhere with her. And we don't realize this because if we really look around and we see people who are a bit older, these are normal tendencies to carry the things that you want to keep special to yourself, things that have sentimental value. So for a man, he's going to check his wallet. He wants to make sure that he has money there. Usually it's the driver's license. It's the ID cards. It's the credit cards. It's the safety of knowing that no matter what happens to him, he's going to be okay because he has that billfold. And
okay,
the same thing with the woman.
Go ahead. We had just a little bit of a delay. Go ahead. Finish.
Okay, and for women, what I found out, not just only personally but professionally, if you open up the purse of a woman who has memory loss, depending upon the stage, what you're going to find is quite a few tissues, quite a few lipsticks, quite a few blushers and eyeliners and things that they normally would not have carried with them years ago because it's under the auspice of in an emergency, they are going to have everything that they're going to need. And it's a safety technique for them. And my theory is as long as it's not harming them or harming anybody around them, you know, these are just the little things that you let go. You don't make a big deal out of it. Even sometimes not even commenting on it is a good thing. Now, there's a flip side to that, Michael, and sometimes people are going through their wallets, believe it or not, because they're bored. You know, nobody is really talking to them, or maybe people are talking too quickly around them and not really engaging them in a conversation. Oftentimes, the TV is on when, you know, there's family gatherings, and it's just so much stimulation. So they're going to retreat backwards. And what do you do when you retreat back? Well, you know, you open up your purse or your wallet. It's very, very calming and self-soothing because in that way you don't have to be involved and you can sort of tune out what's going on around you.
Now, what about one in particular that you address, repeating?
Okay.
Somebody keeps...
That's, Are we there yet? Repetitiveness is probably one of the biggest complaints that I hear early on in the disorder. And now, once again, let's put ourselves in the person with memory loss issues. They know that there's something important that needs to be done, but they can't quite remember what it was that you said. So they're going to ask you. And they'll ask you again and again and again. And all they're looking for is reassurance. Remember, Michael, we grew up and we have responsibilities. And we need to be someplace on time, just like I knew I needed to be someplace tonight. And we take our responsibilities very, very seriously. So, you know, a person with dementia wouldn't be able to go look in their calendar book and say, oh, I have to be somewhere at 6:30. What they do is they keep asking the caregiver, but it's just not sinking in because it's new information. So one of the things that when I'm working with clients, and we talk, and I talk a lot about it in my book, is I want you to put yourself in this person's shoes and to realize that the fact that a person is asking you a question and being repetitive, you almost should get excited because it is a phase. And it means that they're still interested in what's going on. And there will come a day when they won't be asking you those questions. So as long as they're asking you that question, it means they still care. They still care about being somewhere or getting somewhere on time or being involved in your life. So that, to me, is a very positive thing when people are repetitive.
Okay, let's talk about one other thing, and it's a very important, hallucinations, and it does happen.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, just for the record, the majority of hallucinations that happen to people with memory loss are non-threatening. And when I say that they're non-threatening, it's not like a person who's schizophrenic and has different changes to their brain. Usually people will see little children or they'll see pets that aren't there. It's not typically something that happens with Alzheimer's. It's more common with a dementia called Lewy body dementia, which is another form of Parkinson's. But for the most part, people will see things. They will see children. They will see bugs. They'll see animals. But they're not going to be hearing voices. That's very unusual. And they're not usually typically going to be smelling things that aren't there either. So when we're talking about hallucinations, it depends upon what kind of hallucination that they're having.
You know, you bring up some very interesting points. Let's say some of the assisted living places. Do they know what you're talking about? Because somebody has an assisted living place and it's set up for people with dementia, people with Alzheimer's, and they've got people at the desk and people who, you know, are there helping them. Do they really know what we're talking about tonight? And I think that's a very legitimate question to ask.
Okay. It's a really good question. And the reason why I'm pausing here right now is because I want to be able to answer this in such a way that it'll give people reassurance, but yet give them something else to look forward to. Unfortunately, a lot of assisted living facilities are truly not geared for people with memory loss. And I walk into facilities every single day that are advertised as geared for people with dementia. And as you're walking through the halls, you don't see name tags, which I don't feel I think it's against the rules and regulations. People are just incessantly wandering the halls. And you and I might think, wow, this is really, really great because Dad can sit there and just walk around as much as he wants to. What ends up happening is, unfortunately, is that people who have dementia are forgetful. And because they are forgetful, they don't know where they are. And when they don't know where they are, they get scared. And it causes more anxiety. So to have a facility or an institution that just allows them to meander around endlessly is really not a good thing for people with memory loss.
Now, by the way, Natalie, we're starting to run out of time. So do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, I do. It's www.alzheimerscareconsultants.com.
Wonderful. Natalie, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it. And thank you for dealing with the mouse. You were good with that.
And thank you for having me, Michael. It was great.
Okay. A pleasure. Good night.
Good night.
For you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country.
sidewalks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charm.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
My own, I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old, because I want a girl.
Richard Bowles with us. He's the author of What Color's Your Parachute? A Practical Manual for Job Hunters and Career Changes in 2012. The best-selling job hunting book in the world, 10 million copies sold, revised and updated annually. Dick, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
And by the way, thank you so much for being here. Interesting. You know, revised and updated annually. I will bet any amount of money when you first put this book together, 40th Anniversary Now edition, 40 years ago, job hunting was a whole different definition and a whole different world out there.
On the surface, you're absolutely 100% right. Underneath, you're wrong.
Well, I like the wrong part. This is good. That makes the show. but when it comes down to it, with the culture the way it is, the way people look at things differently, the way you were brought up, the way I was brought up, it's not the same attitude that people have today looking for jobs, etc. So let's talk surface, and then we'll go underneath. What is it that you've seen over the 40 years change, the difference between if I go for a job today and I went out for one 40 years ago?
What's changed predominantly is the substance of the job hunt, which is that it's two people trying to decide essentially whether they want to go steady together, has not changed. But the form of that search, the form of that conversation prior to being hired, has changed dramatically.
Now, remember, there was years ago, you would apply for a job that was just basically you. Today, there's 10,000 people applying for the same job. You got the internet. You got all these social networks going on, that it's got to be very scary if somebody does not have the technique to be able to get in and have somebody see their own uniqueness of why they should have that job as opposed to the next guy.
That is true. And what is markedly changed about that is that the government has been the main comforter to job hunters over all these years. And now when the talk in the halls of Washington is about cutting deficits, it's really about cutting jobs, and it's also about cutting support services. The The government over the years used to give job hunters unemployment insurance, used to give them retraining if they needed it, used to give them support week by week with these things called one-stop career centers and that kind of thing, and used to give them statistics and information about what kind of jobs were hiring, what fields were adding new workers, and what fields were not. And the more that we see these budgets starting to be cut, and not only here but in other countries around the world, the more these kinds of services are going to be regarded as optional, and job hunters are going to be more and more on their own in terms of figuring out how to manage their own job hunt in those five areas, how to find money for support while they're out of work, how to get retrained for another occupation if they need to, how to get some kind of support while they're going week by week. Now the average job hunt, I think, takes 37 weeks in this country, and how they get information. And so more and more job hunting is going to become and is becoming, this is the major difference from 40 years ago, it's becoming a survival skill. It used to be nice if you knew how to do it, but if you didn't, somebody would come and try to help you. But now more and more job hunters are finding themselves on their own, and they're going to have to master the techniques of a different kind of job hunt than the ones they were accustomed to when they were younger or when they heard about their father's job hunt.
Dick, let's go underneath the surface now. Let's go to that other part. What's the same? Is it the same dance? Is it the same that, you know, obviously there's a romance there. You've got to do something to cause those people to look at you. And at the same time, you really have to sit back with yourself and say, are these the people I want to be with? So underneath the surface, what is the same?
Well, underneath the surface, the same three questions that I first wrote about 40 years ago still are the most important questions anyone can ask, even today. And that is, what are my favorite transferable skills? What are my favorite knowledges or things I know a lot about? And what are my skills at being able to find the name of that, the name of organizations that have those kinds of jobs, and the person there who has the power to hire? That has remained absolutely unchanged over the 40 years. We find that when people used to go out looking for information because they were out of work, they knew they needed more information, but they erroneously would go and try to find information about the job market, like what kind of jobs are hot jobs, that sort of thing. Now more and more people are realizing they have to sit down and find more information about themselves and do a kind of self-inventory to be able to come up and say, not, I am a construction worker or I am a computer repair person, that sort of label, but rather to say, I'm a person who has these sets of skills, I'm a person who has these sets of knowledges. And that's what's dramatically stayed the same. A person has to know more information. What's changed is what kind of information they need.
You see, I think what you put together in addition to the book is absolutely brilliant because of the mass confusion about how to go out and find a job. I think in today's world, I haven't had a job for probably 40 years now, and I don't think I know what to do to go out and for the first step. But the five-day workshop, you know, that's where the key is, to let someone know exactly what the challenges are ahead. My big problem is the job hunter. If I don't know what the challenges are, I'm in trouble before I even start.
That's right. And you mentioned the five-day workshop. Some of your readers will have no idea what you're talking about. In addition to writing the book, I have what in the old Frankenstein's movies we call my laboratory. And my laboratory is that every 3 months I spend 5 days with about whatever number my house will hold. It's usually 21. I spend 5 days with 21 job hunters or career changers or professionals, and I get to hear right up close what the challenges are that they're meeting and facing, and then I use that information in order to update my book every single year, dramatically this year for the 40th edition.
So in essence, what you really have is a focus group.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that, which is good, because then we're talking practical application that goes into the book, which is not just academia. The book's
you could come up with every kind of theory, but my background is I studied chemical engineering at MIT and physics at Harvard, and I like sciences. I like things that can be tested, and job hunting is one of the finest sciences in the world, because if you say, this will work if you send out X number of resumes and you send out that number and then you don't find a job. Well, you know that didn't work. So the theories are abundant in this field, but the actual thing that's going to save a job hunter is knowing what actual, in actual fact, actually works. And that's what my book is about each year, what actually works.
Yeah, if you do a definition of science, it's just something that's provable, and that's really what you're dealing with here. It's provable. You've gone through it. You've done it year after year after year after year, and when it comes right down to it, it is the science of getting a job. Communication is a science. No matter which way you look at it, it's learned strategy. In today's world, if people don't understand this, they don't get this, again, they're going to be in major trouble. Do you see, now this is for 2012, do you see, based on the economy and some of the things that are happening today, there's going to be any major changes when you do the rewrite of the book for 2013?
No, the major changes in this year's. I was called over by some consultants in Spain in March, and I was called in to help a major membership organization here in the U.S. They're dealing with these questions now, and they are not waiting until next year. In the normal course of events, it would have been slower before these hove into view, but now the issues that I talk about, I would be talking about in 2013, I'm already talking about.
Okay, so in essence, that you're looking really a year ahead before you do anything. Now, this job search, is this for anybody? Is this for the 18-year-old going out on the street or the 55-year-old who now that his industry doesn't need him anymore, he's got to go out and find a job? Is this for everybody?
Yeah, that's a good question, Michael. It all depends on how motivated they are. I've taught this to 10-year-olds. I've taught this to 72-year-olds and everything in between. And my book was rejected for a college course because it was regarded as written at an eighth grade level. So I know I'm explaining things as simply as I possibly can. It isn't that complicated. It isn't that complex. And the things that they need to know can be easily mastered by anybody of any age.
You know, by the way, at an eighth grade level, which is the most important, the most critical thing that you can possibly do, Dick, the one thing I've found over the years of being in communication and doing everything I've ever done is that you can get so much education in school, so much academia, and that's not going to get it for you when you get out. It's called the get out there, fall down, get up, and fall down again. That's when you create the wisdom. Once you got the wisdom.
School of hard knocks.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where it really is. That's what I'm seeing is the Which Color Is Your Parachute, the practical manual for the job hunters and career changers. That's the here it is so you don't have to go through it. Here it is so you don't have to get knocked down. Here it is so you don't have to give up.
That's my hope for sure.
Now, let me ask you this. The book in and of itself, for you, what's your favorite area in the book?
Oh, talking about in this thing, there's another author named Donald Tapscott, and I had breakfast with him. And he made a very cogent observation. He said, it isn't what you see, it's what you notice that determines your life. And I've been talking about that more and more in my workshops. I've been talking about that more and more in my book of the new edition each year, that we have to start paying attention to some different things about ourselves. What exactly are we doing when we're enjoying ourselves the most? What skills are we using at that point? And change what people are noticing, because just what they see doesn't adequately fit them to meet the challenges of this day.
Yeah, no question. And by the way, Tapscott was on the air with us probably 6-8 months ago, something like that. And he was a good guest. And he's dealing with, you know, really social media to tie into things, because that old adage of that the 6 degrees of separation, the world is not like that anymore. It used to be years ago, if you knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, maybe you could reach out to 15, 20, 50 people at the most. Now you reach out, you can reach out to hundreds of millions, and you've got to be able to be on the same level playing field as everybody else out there. And I think what's going on here with the book, this puts you a step ahead of it.
I hope so.
How can it not?
Michael, I'm not taken to blowing my own horn. I'm 84 years old. I have been in this business for a long, long time, and I've learned that letting a book speak for itself is far better than the author trying to boast about it. And
I agree with you in one area, but Dick, I'm going to take you to task on this one area. It's those kids out there that don't know. You know, they. How old did you say you were?
84.
Okay, now 84 years old. Now there, in and of itself, with all of that experience, you're taking 84 years of experience, basically, and you put it into the 360-some-odd pages where somebody doesn't have to wait 84 years to find out how to do it. It's in the book. And my feeling is it's not necessarily bragging about you, yourself. It's stepping outside yourself, giving them the information that they need to be able to grasp, get a hold of, to get it. Because in 10, 15, 20-minute interview, whatever an average is, there's no way we can give an audience everything that the book can. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, do it. And it's not being – humility won't work, because if we do humility, somebody out there is going to miss the real message that we have to give.
Thank you, Michael. I have to say this. You know, the I lost my train of thought. Go ahead.
That's okay. Hey, I'm behind you, but I'm not that far behind you age-wise. So I've seen it. When it really comes down to it, I think what you have is the way to go. Now, let me ask you this. We're just about running out of time.
Yeah.
Do you have a website we can find you at?
JobHuntersBible.com. It's all lowercase, no apostrophe, no space, just JobHuntersBible.com.
One quick question. Was there something, a question that I should have asked you that I didn't ask you that would have brought up the information that somebody would need to hear? Did we miss something?
I just spoke in the city, which is San Francisco, about 3 hours ago, and I talked for 2.5 hours. So if you have an additional 2.5 hours, yes, there are a lot of things I need to mention. But I can't summarize them all in 1 minute.
No, and I got you loud and clear. Dick, we'd love to have you back on. Radio Susie will be contacting you. And thank you so much for joining us. Great work on the book.
Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheer.
We're not really done yet, but the song sounds good.
We'll linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But
back that would trump.
Or even if we are careful. I mean, I don't think Steve Kirsch did anything that wasn't careful, and he ended up in this position.
No,
so,
by the way,
you know,
we're going to have
I think that these are important lessons for us to take away when we think about who we are as U.S. citizens and who we want to become as a nation and a people in the future.
All right, let me close it off with this. I think tolerance should be thrown out the window, and I think the word should be replaced with respect. There is power in respect. Tolerance is garbage because people misuse it, abuse it, and cause a lot of problems with it. So I think the word respect would trump anything that tolerance can do. And with
we definitely need to move beyond tolerance. And if by respect, yeah, what you're talking about is a situation in which equality and freedom is not based on some kind of hierarchical judgment about whether, yeah, you deserve it or not, but it's
got
something
it
that we just, you know, initially, you know, you give to people only, you know, and only take it away when there's actual evidence that, you know, there's some security problem here or some risk, and we have to be very careful about how those things get defined, then sure, I agree with that.
Yeah, by the way, let me give you, we have to go, but let me give you my last definition of an American. I am an American, and I love my country, and I don't even know you, but I love you, okay? Yeah, I would respect you. If we totally disagreed, I'd open a door for you. If you were in trouble, I would be right there to help. And that, I think, is what an American is. And I don't care if you were green, I'd say the same thing to you.
Well, I think the idea is that difference shouldn't be something that, you know, interferes with how people treat one another humanely. And that, whether that's as U.S. citizens or as citizens, you know, how the United States treats people outside of the United States. But, you know, in the context of the U.S., that's, you know,
I hear you. Hey, Cynthia, we got to go. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I've got a Facebook page called I Am an American. If you just Google I Am an American at Facebook, it's there. I've got another website that I'm going to launch in September called it's www.IamAnAmericanProject.com, and that will have all of the films on it and some of the images and text from the book. And the book is I Am an American, Filming the Fear of Difference, which can be found in the United States at the University of Chicago Press, or for people in Britain from Intellect Books. And all of the films are going to end up as part of they've been invited to be part of the permanent collection of the September 11 Memorial Museum that's being built at Ground Zero. So they'll be available online as soon as they can get them cataloged, and they'll be available on site next year when the museum opens.
Dynamite. Cynthia Weber, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Monica Dukia with us. She is the author of Out of the Mirror Clay, How to Overcome a Painful Past and Live Victoriously. She's an accomplished scientist with degrees in chemistry and genetic engineering, has worked with global pharmaceutical and biopharmaceutical sector. She's also a Christian theologian and a conference speaker who holds honors, Bachelor of Theology degree. She's a columnist and a Christian minister who is a sought-after global speaker and the author of two books. One is the Out of the Mary Clay and the Return of the King. And let us say, Monita, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. How are you this afternoon?
Oh, I'm good. Did I pronounce your name right?
You did. You got it right on spot on.
Okay. We got a good start. Let me ask you this. When we really talk about taking a look at the past and becoming all we can be, how does a person transition to that? And Monita, I'm quite confident that you've met so many people they're covered up, they're hiding, they're running around in fear, afraid to be who they are. How do you get them to take that first step to realize the potential that really lies within all of us?
Well, the thing is, Michael, we are a product of our experiences. We can't really dismiss them or forget it. We've got to deal with it. And the only way to transition from your past into your future is to look at it in a sort of a cathartic way. What happened? Why did it happen? What could I do with this? Is this going to paralyze me for the rest of my life? Is it going to dictate who I am, what I'm going to be? Or am I going to look at it and say, look, some of this I've got to deal with. I had nothing to do with it. It just happened. The other part of it is I'm going to take this and I'm going to turn this into something positive and press on. So it's entirely up to the person what you're going to do. And a lot of people, unfortunately, it's a lot more easy to sort of forget it, hide it, insulate yourself in lies about it. Just ignore the problem. Sweep it under the carpet. It's going to go away. Well, it does not, because a lot of times what happens to you, it's in your psyche. It's not going anywhere. It just gets worse and worse.
No,
and
Monita,
you find yourself
years
later, and you're looking at this problem. There's just snowballing.
Now, you said it. It's in your psychic. And I think one of the major problems is, how do I deal with a problem that I don't know that I have? Most of us work on a problem that we don't have as opposed to the one we do have, and we end up never getting anywhere. So having it in your psychic, and obviously everything we've ever done, seen, felt, experienced is held somewhere in that brain in one particular part of the mind, wherever it may be. So it's held there. You see something in life, you recognize an experience that was like something that happened to you. It doesn't have to be specific, but it could be close enough. And then we find ourselves reacting to that experience. We're reacting to somebody in front of us that has nothing to do with what went on 20, 30, 40 years ago. So it's the recognition of the problem, and it's getting to the problem, I think, is the real problem, quote unquote.
Yeah, it's sort of the one thing you go ask yourself is, why am I behaving like this? For instance, you've got a trigger, and you might not know it's something in your past that happened to you when you were a child, and it's this trigger, and you've just gone off the deep end, and you go mental on it without even realizing why you're behaving like this. And I think it's important to ask yourself, why am I doing this? Is it normal? How does it impact the other person or people around? Why do I react like this? How does it impact me? Is it positive? Is it negative? You know, a lot of times we say things, and I'm guilty of this sometimes. I get angry, and I might say something, and I don't think about it. And I don't realize it's going to hurt somebody. And then after that, I look at it, and I thought, well, that wasn't very good. But a lot of people, they're so wrapped up in what has happened and in their own little world, because really they've got this mask of pain and despair, and they're really trying to survive. They're in survival mode. Yes, you can exist in survival mode, but really I think it's living in defeat. It's not in victory, is it? Because you're only in survival mode. There's so many other things you can experience. There's a whole world out there. There's a whole life out there just waiting for you, and yet you're caught up in the past, or you're stuck in one phase, and you're not getting out.
No, survival
that's
mode.
That's what I do. I try to get people to sort of step out of their shell.
Okay,
you know,
but survival mode
of your
is a chemical
and
reaction.
Deal with the problems. Deal with it spot on. Otherwise,
no,
it's
question,
not going to go away.
But let me go back to where I was with that. Survival mode is a chemical reaction. And I think that in and of itself, when we begin to understand the dynamic of our body and our mind and our brain and the emotions and all those chemicals that cause us to do and be who we are and the end result of all of our actions. Because if you can make that transition, if that one thought, that one look somebody's giving you doesn't have the same meaning it had 30 years ago, the chemistry changes. And instead of adrenaline, you're pumping dopamine, quote unquote. And I think that in and of itself is a realization that you don't have to be and feel what you felt in your life. Most people go through life thinking that they have to do it. Now, let me take this on a personal level with you. What was this that brought this about with you, for you? What was it that caused you to look at this issue, study it, put it to pen, and then take the step to help people?
Well, honestly, I mean, I'm a scientist, and it's sort of funny because my friends always laugh. I'm a scientist, and I'm a Christian minister as well. And, you know, I was married, I had a thriving ministry, and everything went well. And what happened, I was devastated with a spouse who cheated, stole everything, and I lost everything. My whole world came crumbling down. Everything you could think about happened, happened. That should not happen. And at the end, I was standing there left with nothing. So I had two ways I could go. One, go spiraling down. I had every reason to go that way because it was just ridiculous. It was heinous. No one should go through that. And then there was this other path whereby I could say to myself, well, you know what? I'm going to get through this. I have got to deal with this spot on, head on. So I had to make that choice. And it was not an easy choice, but for me, it was the only choice. I didn't want to go down that other path, and it was perfectly fine. It's easy. It made sense. But in life, you've got... It's a fork in the road. What are you going to do? Everybody's going to come to a fork in the road, and you're going to have to choose one. So for me personally, going through the path that I wanted to go through and coming out victoriously, that's why I wrote Out of the Miry Clay. I'm a scientist. I mean, I'm used to boardrooms and laboratories and FDA conferences and all that. I'm a scientist, but what happened to me changed me forever. And I penned Out of the Miry Clay because I wanted to reach out to those people that I know that are hurting and they're hiding and are just wearing masks and are pretending everything is great. But inside, they're numb. And it's not a way for anybody to live.
No question about it. Abuse comes in many, many different sizes and shapes and form. You can be beaten. You can be emotionally beaten. You can have everything, as you said, stolen from you. And that in and of itself is an abuse. But I think the real question is this. You know, we have in this country that women who are abused, that for the most part, there are groups or organizations, there's some kind of collaboration. There's always that support system that if you know where to go to, that they're there to help, that truly have an understanding that most people won't. Because you have to have been there, done that, before you can actually sit down with somebody to discuss it with them. I think the real problem, not necessarily in this country, but in other countries, in cultures who come to this country who don't consider women as equal citizens, you know, they're the products, they're property. Then you've got the problem, because then I think those are the women that really need to be reached. And it's very hard because they have those challenges and all that pain around them that every time they go to step up to the plate, they get knocked down. How do you handle that? And that is not an easy question.
Well, first of all, let me preface that by saying I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. I mean, being a minister and being in industry for so long, even in the workplace, I've come across so many people in the pharmaceutical and biopharmaceutical sector who are VPs and CEOs and directors and all that, who are being abused, but they choose not to talk about it because they're embarrassed. And you can have as many organizations as you want, but no one wants to step out and say, hey, I'm a victim, because they're embarrassed. These are not people who are, you know, working at Walmart or something. These are people with advanced degrees. These are people who lead corporations. And they're abused, but they hide it. I know. I was one of those people. I could tell you. And then we've got the other side of the coin that has got a cultural thing to it. And, yes, we work in different cultures. I do a lot of work in Asia, and I do a lot of work in South America. And when I go there, it just breaks your heart. I mean, people are so battered and traumatized, they've got no clue of how to be human anymore. And that always catches me off guard. No matter how many times I go there and I talk to them, it just numbs me for a point where I don't know what to do sometimes. Because you can talk and you can talk, but unless the person understands that the behavior being heaped on them is abuse, they're not going to deal with it.
It's going beyond.
In different cultures, for instance, in Asian cultures or South American cultures, a lot of times they don't even know that they're being abused. Whereas I find in Western civilizations, for instance, in the UK, when I go there and I minister, it's more of, yes, I do know I'm being abused, but I'm not going to talk about it because it's my dirty little secret and I don't want anyone to know about it. So it's trying to draw people out of their shell, whether it's Western or Eastern or wherever it is. And that's the most difficult part, is getting someone to admit or to even see it for what it is.
Admitting it, and it's going to be a very interesting point, because if you admit it, the major problem is this. If you admit it, then all of a sudden that means that the life that you know and the people that you're around, you may lose. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because if you're being abused, get out of there. But that's easier said than done. That's
exactly.
A very interesting thing when you're dealing with people.
It is. It is. It's very difficult. And, you know, like I told you when I talk about the fork in the road, it was so easy for me to say, you know what, I'm going to deal with this divorce and deal with all of what has happened to me and what I'm going through and get back to my little fancy little senior director and VP position and carry on with it. But as a minister, I knew I had to do something, because this is not the way. We could all ignore the problem, but it's not going to go away. And a lot of people are just living in a substandard existence, and I don't think it's right.
No question about it.
Go ahead.
No, I just said no question about it. It's not right. And at the same time, you have to, and you said you have to be able to, first you have to recognize it. I don't even think you have to understand it. It's recognize it. You understand that. That's in that intellectual part of your brain. You recognize it. It goes to your emotional part of your brain. That's going to be the stimulant to create some kind of action. But the point
of contention, you've got to recognize it. You've got to say, look, I don't want to live like this anymore. And that's what I do in my conferences when I talk to people and I tell them it's the most precious thing in your life. It's not money and all those things, the pretty things you can buy. It is time. And once you lose time, you can't gain that time anymore. It's gone. So make sure you live your life to the fullest.
No, and by the way, no question whatsoever. We are starting to run out of time. Monita, let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. My website is www.outofthemireclay.net.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. And I think that you're right there and you're spot on for this time in our world and our history, because there's a lot of women out there that, especially now, that they have so much to offer, but they're blindsided and they're held back. And maybe it's time that they knew that it was okay.
I'll leave with one quote. Eleanor Roosevelt said, "No one can make you feel inferior without your permission."
Absolutely.
So
and
stop
with
giving
that,
people the permission to make you feel inferior and live victoriously.
And thank you for that. And with that, thank you so much for being with us, and good night.
Good night.
All these songs to enfold you, and a long time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Well, that's all. That's all.
a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms. I know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. As I grow old, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Ted McLyman with us, CEO of Apex Behavioral Group. He's a fully licensed financial advisor, and he's an author. And prior to forming the company, he was a district manager with two major financial planning firms. He's a retired Lieutenant Colonel USMC, where he served in various commands and staff positions to include economics instructor, U.S. Naval Academy, aide to the Assistant Secretary of the Navy of the Financial Management, and served a tour in Southwest Asia during the Operation Desert Storm. And he's also an accomplished public speaker and a trainer. And let's say, Ted, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here tonight.
Oh, thank you. Can we start with this? Semper Fi.
Say again, please.
I said we can start Semper Fi.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, by the way, me too. Okay.
Yeah, really? Good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's the Green Gun Club. It got us where we are today. That's all I can say.
I'll tell you that one, but I was in way back when, and as a matter of fact, I went through boot camp at MCRD in 1960. So it was a couple of years.
You're ahead of me by a couple of years.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. The book, Money Makes Me Crazy, Prescriptions for Money Sanity. In today's world, do we actually have any kind of a definition for money? Because I think really, when you're dealing with financial literacy, for the most part, most people don't get it. And you have a definition of money when you're 15, 16 years old. You get another definition when you're 20 based on your life, something else at 35, 40, and then it moves on from there. But the key here basically is this. Most people are using their 15-year-old definition when they're in their 20s and their mid-20s, and that is enough to make them crazy. So do we first have
to... Oh, you got it.
You
bring up a really good point. I think money is kind of a euphemism right now for about anything you want to call it, a good time, life, happiness, whatever. But what we're finding in our research, and we discuss in the book, is number one, money is biological. Our brains are really not wired to work well with money. Our brains biologically are about 100,000 years old, and the behavior that kept us alive in the forest is killing us at the mall. Number two, it's our belief system. Most of us learn about money when we're growing up, and by the time we're about 12 years old, we have a pretty good idea of what money is, good, bad, or indifferent. But it really does make a foundational set for what we do in the rest of our lives. Culture is another thing that dictates how we look at money. I mean, all you've got to do is walk around, head to the mall. We're a consumption culture, and that is a significant impact. But I think most importantly, the rules of money have changed. And what we learned about money as a kid or what you learned in high school probably isn't appropriate today in today's economy.
No, absolutely. I know somebody now, which is very interesting. She has a very limited income, and this has been this way most of her life. She has a very limited income, and the minute that she gets money monthly, the first thing she goes out and does is she spends it. Now, it's all gone.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. And then she can worry about not having any money.
Well, and again, that's a behavioral thing.
Yes.
I think the common wisdom that we have in our society, that money is there to spend, and we think that spending is going to make us happy. And in reality, from a biological perspective and a cultural perspective, it really doesn't. It's the quest that makes us happy. It's